You are listening to This Week in Palestine, Truth and Justice Radio, WZBC, Boston College. Before we begin, a brief reminder. The views expressed in this hour belong to our hosts and guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WZBC, Boston College, or its Board of Trustees. This is not a space for polite restraint. This is a space for truth spoken clearly, urgently, and without apology. Good morning, good evening, wherever you're listening from, thank you for joining us. I'm your host and narrator, Abby Masri, and you're tuned into This Week in Palestine. Today is Sunday, February 22nd, 2026. This Week in Palestine is a space where truth isn't shaped to comfort the powerful, where resistance is not metaphor, but the rhythm of daily survival, and where solidarity is not a passing gesture, but a heartbeat carried across generations. From the heart of occupation, voices rise, not alone, not as whispers swallowed by empire, but together, in step with movements around the world that insist on justice, dignity, and liberation for all. This is more than a broadcast. It is a lifeline, a thread stretching from Palestine to every corner of the globe, binding shattered homes to unbroken hope, binding rubble to resolve, binding grief to a future still worth imagining. A reminder that even in the darkest nights, the flame of defiance refuses to fade. Each week, we bring reporting that refuses disguise, analysis that cuts through distortion, and reflections that center Palestinian life in all its depth, struggle, beauty, and humanity. We do not soften. We do not dilute. We speak with clarity because the stakes are far too high for anything less than truth. We trace the architecture of power, the policies that suffocate, the narratives that erase, the forces that silence, and we follow their echoes across borders, from Ferguson to Jenin, from refugee camps to classrooms, from Gaza to the conscience of the world. This Week in Palestine is not a refuge for polite avoidance. It is testimony. It is urgency. It is solidarity without apology. Because the struggle for liberation is not confined to one land, one people, or one moment in time. It is shared. It is global. And it is sacred. In today's episode, I want to speak directly about the pain of Palestinians. Not just the pain of those living under occupation, but also the pain carried by anyone, anywhere in the world, who dares to stand with them. Because in this moment, solidarity itself has become a risk, and the cost of speaking the truth has never been higher. Day after day, I look around and I feel the pressure tightening. More surveillance, more censorship, more control coming from powerful institutions, from governments, from media systems that shape what we're allowed to see and what we're encouraged to forget. It's suffocating. But even that suffocation is nothing compared to what Palestinians endure every single day. Just imagine, for a moment, living in occupied Palestine. Whether you're in Gaza, the West Bank, Jaffa, Haifa, Hebron, or any of the hundreds of villages scattered across the land, your life is shaped by forces you cannot escape. Imagine waking up and discovering that your home has been demolished. Imagine watching your loved ones vanish, taken, displaced, or killed. Imagine seeing your grandfather's farm, the land your family tended for generations, harvested by strangers who arrived from thousands of miles away, claiming a history that is not theirs and a right that was never given. This is not a metaphor. This is not a distant memory. This is the daily reality for millions of Palestinians. And today, I want to talk about something that doesn't get enough attention. The pain you are put through simply for speaking about this reality. Because the moment you say a word, just one word about Palestinian suffering, you become a target. You are questioned, you are monitored, you are labeled, you are silenced. We've seen journalists lose their jobs for asking a single honest question. We've seen students arrested for holding a flag. We've seen influencers banned from platforms for posting footage that contradicts the official narrative. We've seen ordinary people, teachers, nurses, artists, face harassment simply for expressing empathy. And this is where the pain expands beyond Palestine. It reaches anyone who refuses to look away. Because the truth is this: the world is not only trying to control Palestinians, it is trying to control the people who stand with them. It is trying to control the story, the language, the memory, the narrative. And when you control the narrative, you control the world's conscience. That is why speaking up matters. That is why witnessing matters. That is why refusing to be silent matters. Because every time someone tells the truth, whether they're in Bethlehem or Boston, Gaza or Chicago, Haifa or London, they break through the wall of silence that has been built around this issue for decades. And that is what terrifies those who benefit from that silence. So today's episode is not just about the pain of Palestinians. It is about the pain of truth tellers, the pain of witnesses, the pain of people who refuse to let injustice hide behind polite language and sanitized headlines. If you dare to speak, you will feel the pressure. You will feel the backlash. You will feel the weight of systems that want you quiet. But you will also feel something else. Something stronger, the knowledge that you are standing on the side of humanity, the side of dignity, the side of truth. And that is a pain worth carrying. Over the past few weeks, the news cycle has narrowed itself to three dominant headlines: the supposed ceasefire in Gaza, the release of the Epstein files, and the rising possibility of a regional war involving Iran. But let's start with the first one, because it's the one most people think they understand. We keep hearing about a ceasefire, a pause, a moment of calm, a diplomatic breakthrough. But on the ground, in Gaza, nothing resembling a ceasefire has taken place. What we're witnessing is not peace, it's a narrative, a carefully constructed illusion designed to give the world the impression that the violence has stopped, that the crisis is stabilizing, that the pressure can ease. This is how narrative management works. You don't need to change the reality, you only need to change the language describing it. And that brings us to something deeper, something older than this war, older than this moment, older even than the state of Israel itself. It brings us to the politics of naming. Let's talk about Palestine. Not Gaza, not the West Bank, not the Palestinian territories. I'm talking about historical Palestine, from the river to the sea. A land with thousands of years of history, culture, and identity. Before the Zionist movement arrived in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, every map, every newspaper, every radio station, every traveler's journal referred to this land as Palestine. after the Nakba in 1948, that naming began to shift, slowly, deliberately, strategically. First, it became occupied Palestine, then disputed territories, then Israel and the Palestinian territories. And now, in most mainstream media, the word Palestine is almost entirely absent. Instead, we hear Gaza. We hear the West Bank. We hear Arabs. We hear Muslims. But rarely, very rarely, do we hear Palestinians. And almost never do we hear Palestine. This is not an accident. This is not a linguistic coincidence. This is a political project. Because if you erase the name, you weaken the claim. If you erase the identity, you weaken the people. If you erase the history, you weaken the right to return, the right to land, the right to memory. And today, that erasure is happening not only in political speeches or media coverage, it's happening in museums, in textbooks, in menus, in tourism brochures, in the everyday language of people who don't even realize they've been taught to forget. Just this week, a friend sent me a menu from an Israeli restaurant, a menu filled with dishes every Palestinian, every Jordanian, every Lebanese, every Syrian, every Egyptian would recognize instantly. Falafel, hummus, baba ganoush, shakshuka, stuffed grape leaves, tabbouleh, makluba, knafe. These foods are not religious. They are not tied to one faith or one ethnicity. They are regional. They are Levantine. They are Arab. They are Palestinian. A Muslim Palestinian eats them. A Christian Syrian eats them. A Jewish Egyptian eats them. A Druze Lebanese eats them. A Coptic Egyptian eats them. A Bedouin Jordanian eats them. The variations are in the spices, the techniques, the family traditions, not in the ownership. But when an Israeli restaurant markets these dishes as Israeli cuisine, it's not just a culinary claim, it's part of a larger pattern, the appropriation of culture as a tool of political legitimacy. Because if you can convince the world that the food is Israeli, and the clothing is Israeli, and the music is Israeli, and the land is Israeli, then eventually you can convince them that the people who lived there before, the Palestinians, were never really there at all. This is cultural erasure. This is narrative warfare. This is the rewriting of history in real time. And it goes beyond food. It goes beyond language. It goes beyond maps. It reaches into the heart of identity. Take Palestinian Christians, for example, a community that predates the State of Israel by 2,000 years, a community that predates Christianity in Europe, a community that has lived continuously in Bethlehem, Beit Jala, Jerusalem, Nazareth, and Gaza since the earliest days of the faith. Yet today, Israeli officials routinely claim that Israel is the only place in the Middle East where Christians are safe. Meanwhile, Palestinian Christian leaders, priests, bishops, community elders, report harassment, land confiscation, restrictions on worship, and rising attacks by extremist settlers. Church properties have been vandalized, clergy have been assaulted, Christian cemeteries have been desecrated, and the separation wall cuts Bethlehem's Christian neighborhoods off from Jerusalem, making access to holy sites nearly impossible. But in the Western media, these stories rarely make it to air. Why? Because acknowledging the suffering of Palestinian Christians disrupts the narrative that this is a religious conflict between Muslims and Jews. It reveals the truth. This is a political conflict, a colonial conflict, a conflict over land, rights, and power. And that truth is inconvenient. So instead, the narrative shifts, the language shifts, the naming shifts. And slowly, the world forgets. This is why the fight for naming matters. This is why the word Palestine matters. This is why cultural preservation matters. Because erasure is not always loud. Sometimes it's quiet. Sometimes it's subtle. Sometimes it's a menu. Sometimes it's a museum label. Sometimes it's a news headline. Sometimes it's the absence of a word that should be there. But every act of erasure, large or small, adds up. And every act of remembering, large or small, pushes back. So when we talk about ceasefires that don't exist, or menus that rewrite culinary history, or museums that remove the word Palestine, or media outlets that refuse to say our name, we are talking about the same struggle. The struggle to exist. The struggle to be seen. The struggle to be named. The struggle to be remembered. And that struggle is not new. It is not temporary. It is not limited to one moment in time. It is generational. It is ongoing. It is global. And it is ours. Over the last year, we have witnessed something unprecedented. It wasn't a shift in policy in Washington or a headline in the New York Times that changed the conversation about Palestine. It was us. It was the influencers, the students, the former beauty queens, and the band activists who took over the digital town square when the traditional gatekeepers locked the doors. Today, we are going to connect the dots. We are going to look at why the mainstream media, from America to the Middle East, failed to tell the truth about the Palestinian struggle. And we are going to look at the crackdown on the voices that tried to tell it anyway. We'll talk about Carrie Prejean, who stood up to a presidential commission and got fired for it. We'll talk about Guy Christensen, whose TikTok was killed after the Oracle takeover. You know who I mean by Oracle, Larry Ellison, the Zionist Larry Ellison. We also going to talk about Candace Owens, Tucker Carlson, Francesca Albanese, and we'll ask the question, what is really going on? Let's start with the elephant in the room. For decades, the coverage of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict has been filtered through a very specific lens. If you turned on American news or even many Middle Eastern TV channels, you were served a narrative where the occupation is called a dispute, where illegal settlements are called neighborhoods, and where the indigenous people resisting displacement are often labeled as terrorists. Why did this happen? It's not a conspiracy theory, it's a structural reality. Investigative reports have highlighted how individuals with deep ties to Zionist organizations occupy key gatekeeping positions in Western media. For example, reports have surfaced regarding the BBC, where critics point to the significant influence of editors with ties to pro-Israel lobbying groups and even intelligence agencies, effectively shaping the narrative to exclude the Palestinian experience. But just because the news failed us, ordinary people, Americans, Europeans, Arabs, Eastern, Muslims, Christians, Jews, and non-believers from all over the world started asking questions, and that is when the establishment got scared. The episode was viewed over 1.8 million times in just 10 hours, and it provoked a response from the highest levels. The U.S. ambassador in Tel Aviv, Mike Huckabee, sent Carlson a direct message on X, challenging him to a debate. "Instead of talking about me, why don't you talk to me directly? You seem to be stirring up a lot of controversy about the Middle East. Why are you afraid of the truth?" Carlson responded immediately, "Thank you very much. I'd be delighted. We will contact your office today to schedule an interview." Commentators noted that Huckabee may have put himself in a predicament by confronting Carlson, who possesses a broad religious and political background and has a knack for exposing what activists called Israeli lies about the treatment of Christians. But Carlson's reporting has not gone unnoticed by the Zionist lobby. A study by the Jewish People Policy Institute, published in December 2025, analyzed roughly 3,000 YouTube videos from Carlson and Candace Owens. The study found that Carlson's references to Israel became markedly more negative over the course of 2025, with about 70% of them being negative in the last 6 months of the year, up from about half in the previous period. Notably, the study acknowledged that Carlson's content does not include consistent or explicit anti-Semitic statements. He has condemned outright anti-Semitism, but critics point out that he has provided an uncritical platform to people who are openly anti-Semitic, including Holocaust denier Nick Fuentes. And some of his statements have drawn sharp criticism. He has compared the assassination of Charlie Kirk to the killing of Jesus, blaming the latter on people in Jerusalem sitting around eating hummus. He has suggested that Jeffrey Epstein was an asset of Israeli intelligence and that Israel had foreknowledge of the September 11th attacks. For this, he has been labeled by some as the most dangerous anti-Semite in American history. Jonathan Tobin, editor-in-chief of JNS, argues that Carlson deserves that distinction because of his mainstream appeal and strong connections to Republican leaders. He claims that Carlson's goal is not so much to break up the U.S.-Israel alliance, but to write Judaism out of Western civilization. But Carlson's supporters see it differently. They see a journalist who is asking the questions that no one else will ask. They see a man who went to the Holy Land and documented the decline of Christian communities, a story that mainstream media has ignored for decades. They see someone who is willing to challenge the foreign policy consensus that has dominated Washington for generations. And Carlson himself has made his position clear. In his report on Christians in the Holy Land, he frames the issue as fundamentally political. How Christians are treated in the Holy Land is a political question because much of what happens in this region is funded by the United States, particularly by U.S. churches. He points to American military support, taxpayer funding, and the financial backing of American evangelical institutions as factors that give Washington a direct stake in what happens there. His conclusion is simple. The treatment of Christians in Israel and the occupied territories is a scandal that has been hidden from the American people, and he is determined to expose it. So here we are. Francesca Albanese, targeted by three European governments and sanctioned by the United States simply for doing her job. Tucker Carlson, labeled the most dangerous anti-Semite in American history simply for documenting the truth about Christian persecution. Carrie Prejean, fired from a presidential commission for refusing to bend the knee. Guy Christensen, expelled from university and banned from social media for speaking out. Candace Owens, threatened by the Israeli Knesset and denounced by her former allies, still standing and still talking. They are not all the same. They come from different backgrounds, different political traditions, different faiths. But they have one thing in common. They refuse to be silent. And for that, the machine tried to destroy them. The machine failed, and it will keep failing because the truth is coming out, and no number of bans, expulsions, sanctions, or smear campaigns can stop it. This is the heart of the debate. When Carrie Prejean defended Candace at that commission hearing, she said, "She's not an anti-Semite, she just doesn't support Zionism." But Seth Dillon of the Babylon Bee pushed back, arguing that Candace goes far beyond opposing Zionism. She uses Jew and Zionist interchangeably and has suggested Israel is the synagogue of Satan. We pointed this earlier, but a study by the Jewish People Policy Institute analyzed roughly 3,000 YouTube videos and found that over the final 6 months of 2025, three-quarters of Candace's videos that referenced Jews were classified as anti-Semitic by their analysis. They called her rhetoric a flashing warning light for Israel and Jewish communities worldwide. So where does that leave us? Is Candace Owens a hero fighting a corrupt power structure, or is she promoting ancient hatreds? The answer probably depends on where you sit, but one thing is undeniable. She has become the single most prominent American voice questioning Zionist power, and the establishment, from the Israeli Knesset to Ben Shapiro to the mainstream media, is terrified of her. So why all this control? Why silence Carrie Prejean? Why destroy Guy Christensen's academic record? Why ban Beeson Oda? Why going after Candace Owens? It's because they are exposing the endgame. We are often told that the conflict is about a two-state solution, about borders, about security. But the ideology driving the current far-right Israeli government is something called Greater Israel. This isn't a secret. It's written in their history. David Ben-Gurion spoke of the establishment of a state as a beginning, not an end. Netanyahu has spoken about his spiritual mission to expand the land of Israel. The reality is that the Zionist project, in its most radical form, doesn't stop at Gaza or the West Bank. The ambition, rooted in certain interpretations of biblical texts, stretches from the Nile in Egypt to the Euphrates in Iraq. That means they want Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, Sinai, and parts of Saudi Arabia. This is why there is so much pressure on Arab governments to normalize relations. It's why the West is so desperate to destabilize countries like Syria and Iraq. They are paving the way for this expansion. And when we have clowns running our countries, leaders in America and Europe who follow the instructions from A to Z, they are complicit in this. And this brings us to the ultimate question. How do they control the clowns? Oops, sorry, I mean our leaders. We are told that America and Europe are sovereign nations, but we see politicians fall in line on Israel without question. Republicans and Democrats compete over who is more pro-Israel. Why? Because the price of disobedience is too high. We saw a glimpse of this with the Epstein files. Jeffrey Epstein wasn't just a pedophile, he was an intelligence asset. He was connected to the highest levels of finance and power. Recent analysis of the unredacted documents shows that Epstein was a major financial supporter of organizations like the Friends of the Israel Defense Forces, FIDF, and the Jewish National Fund, which is directly involved in land acquisition and settlement expansion in Palestinian territories. This is the nexus of blackmail and power. The Epstein files are the insurance policy. They are the sword hanging over the head of any politician who dares to step out of line. We haven't heard all the facts yet. What's hidden is worse than what's been released. But we know enough to understand that the political class in the West is compromised. They are terrified of being Epsteined, so they obey. They send weapons. They veto ceasefires. They bow down. But the truth is coming out, and no number of bans, expulsions, or Epstein blackmail can stop it. So, what is going on after all of this? A shift. A tectonic shift. The mainstream media failed us. The politicians are compromised. The tech platforms tried to silence us. But they failed. Carrie Prejean spoke out, and even in her firing, inspired millions. Guy Christensen was expelled, but a federal court gave him justice, and the people brought his platform back. Palestinian influencers are fighting every day to show us the truth. They want to control us. They want us to believe their myth. But we are waking up. We are asking questions. We are standing up for Palestine, not just as a political cause, but as a symbol of resistance against a global machine of control. The truth is coming out, and no number of bans, expulsions, or Epstein blackmail can stop it. When traditional media refused to show the reality on the ground, a new generation of journalists and influencers took over. They were the eyewitnesses. They were the ones documenting the genocide in real time. But the moment they started gaining traction, the crackdown began. Take the case of Bissan Oda, the Palestinian journalist whose documentation from Gaza earned her an Emmy. Recently, her TikTok account was suddenly banned. It was later restored, but with heavy restrictions, shadow banning her content from recommendations. This happened right as TikTok's ownership structure came under scrutiny in the U.S., with reports of increasing pressure on content related to Palestine. And it wasn't just Palestinians. Meta, the parent company of Instagram and Facebook, has repeatedly suspended accounts like that of Saleh Al-Jafarawi, known as Mr. Fafo, who had millions of followers documenting the war. They cited vague, dangerous organizations policies, effectively silencing voices that contradicted the official narrative. This is the new front line. Zionism isn't just trying to control governments, it's trying to control what you see on your phone. They want you to believe the killers are the victims and that the Palestinians are the aggressors or the thieves of land. They want to cement the myth of Israel as the underdog, even as it flexes military might across the region. One of the most glaring examples of this digital suppression is the story of Guy Christensen. Guy is a pro-Palestinian activist with millions of followers. He was a student at Ohio State University. During the summer break, he posted videos on TikTok expressing his views on Zionism and criticizing specific politicians. The reaction was swift and brutal. Ohio State University expelled him. They didn't just suspend him, they erased his student status, citing that his videos caused concern. What did the video say? In one, he commented on the shooting of two Israeli embassy officials. Initially, he condemned it, but then he retracted that condemnation, stating he would not mourn the death of Zionist officials. In another, he criticized Congressman Richie Torres. The university claimed this incited violence, but a federal judge just saw it differently. In a landmark ruling, the judge ordered Ohio State to expunge his record, stating that his words, however offensive to some, were protected speech and that he was denied due process. But the targeting didn't stop with the university. Recently, Guy Christensen's YouTube channel was terminated and his TikTok account came under intense pressure, specifically after the platform's ownership dynamics shifted with Oracle's involvement. YouTube eventually reinstated his channel after massive public backlash, proving that if we scream loud enough, they have to listen. But the message is clear. Criticize Israel, and they will try to destroy your life, your education, and your livelihood. Now let's talk about someone you might not expect to find in the pro-Palestinian camp, Carrie Prejean. Some of you might remember her as Miss California USA, the pageant queen who made headlines years ago for her views on traditional marriage. She reemerged recently as a member of President Trump's Religious Liberty Commission. You would think a commission on religious liberty would be a safe space for discussing human rights, right? Wrong. During a hearing on anti-Semitism, Carrie Prejean Bowler did something remarkable. She started asking the wrong questions. Not wrong for us, I'm sure you know what I mean. She defended Candace Owens, who has been vocally pro-Palestinian and critical of Israel, arguing that criticizing Israel is not anti-Semitic. She pressed witnesses on whether Zionism itself was conflating with Judaism, and she questioned whether the commission was being hijacked by a political agenda rather than a religious one. The backlash was immediate. The chairman of the commission, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, removed her, accusing her of pushing a personal and political agenda. But Carrie didn't go quietly. She fired back with a statement that sent shockwaves through the political world. She said, This is a gross overstepping of your role and leads me to believe you are acting in alignment with a Zionist political framework that hijacked the hearing. I refuse to bend the knee to Israel. I am no slave to a foreign nation, but to Christ our King. She was fired for refusing to bend the knee to Israel. Let that sink in. A Christian woman on a religious liberty commission was removed for suggesting that religious liberty should apply to everyone, including Palestinians, and for refusing to put a foreign government's political interests above her faith. That is the power of the Zionist lobby. It doesn't just target Muslims, it targets anyone who threatens its narrative, regardless of their political affiliation. And that brings us to Candace Owens. If Carrie Prejean is the one who got fired, Candace Owens is the one they've been trying to destroy for years, and she's still standing. Candace Owens was once the darling of the conservative movement. She was the director of urban engagement for Turning Point USA. She was hired by Ben Shapiro's Daily Wire. She met with Donald Trump in the Oval Office, who hailed her as so good for our country. But then came October 7th, and Candace started asking questions. She started calling what was happening in Gaza a genocide. She started questioning U.S. support for Israel, and the machine turned on her. In March 2024, Candace Owens parted ways with the Daily Wire. The official statements were vague, but everyone knew the truth. She was fired because of her views on Israel. Ben Shapiro, her boss and a staunch Zionist, couldn't tolerate her refusal to fall in line. But it didn't stop there. In January 2026, an Israeli lawmaker from the Likud party, Dan Illouz, stood up in the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, and named Candace Owens and Tucker Carlson as enemies. He called their influence a poison being sold to the American people as patriotism and intellectual vandalism. Candace's response was immediate and fearless. She posted on X, "The Likud party in Israel just named me and Tucker Carlson as enemies that must be fought. These people are murderers. Murderers are threatening me and Tucker Carlson over speech." She asked the question we should all be asking, how is this at all acceptable to our government? A foreign political party is naming American citizens as enemies for exercising their First Amendment rights, and our government says nothing. That tells you everything you need to know about who's really in control. Things escalated further after the tragic assassination of Charlie Kirk, the founder of Turning Point USA, in September 2025. Candace began asking questions about his death that no one else would ask. She suggested that Kirk might have been killed because he was about to abandon the pro-Israel cause, and she implied that people within his own organization and perhaps foreign governments were involved. For this, she has been labeled a conspiracy theorist, a grifter, and an anti-Semite. Tim Pool called her an evil scumbag. Ben Shapiro denounced her at Turning Point's America Fest conference, warning that the conservative movement was in danger from charlatans who claimed to speak in the name of principle, but actually traffic in conspiracism and dishonesty. But here's the thing. Candace keeps asking questions, she keeps pushing, and her audience keeps growing. As of this writing, her podcast is ranked 9th on Spotify's charts, ahead of almost every other right-wing show except Tucker Carlson's. A single TikTok video she posted recently was viewed over 14 million times. Just earlier this month, Candace posted something that really broke the internet. She wrote, "Yes, we are ruled by satanic pedophiles who work for Israel. Everyone needs to digest that fact now. This is the synagogue of Satan we are up against." Now, I'm going to be honest with you. That language is strong. It's biblical. It's referencing Revelation, and it caused immediate outrage. The post was viewed 1.4 million times in hours, with tens of thousands of engagements. Critics say this is outright anti-Semitism. Dennis Prager, a Jewish commentator who once employed Candace at PragerU, wrote an open letter to her, pleading with her to stop. He argued that claims about the Talmud and Jewish control are age-old anti-Semitic tropes that have no basis in reality. But Candace's supporters say she's simply using the language of the Bible to describe a political and spiritual battle. They point out that Jesus himself called out the synagogue of Satan in Revelation. They argue that she's not attacking Jews as a people, but a specific power structure, Zionism, that she believes has hijacked governments, media, and even the church. And in the midst of this growing resistance, two more voices were heard that the establishment simply could not ignore. Tucker Carlson, the most watched independent journalist in America, and Francesca Albanese, a UN expert whose only crime was telling the truth about genocide. Let's start with Francesca Albanese. She is the UN Special Rapporteur on the Occupied Palestinian Territories. She is an Italian lawyer, a scholar, and one of the most respected human rights experts in the world. And for the past year, she has been subjected to one of the most vicious smear campaigns we have ever seen, all because she dared to document what Israel is doing in Gaza. It began in early February 2026. Albanese participated in a forum organized by Al Jazeera in Qatar. During that forum, she gave a speech, and almost immediately, a coordinated disinformation campaign was launched against her. A French lawmaker named Caroline Yadin stood up in Parliament and claimed that Albanese had described Israel as the common enemy of humanity. French Foreign Minister Jean-Noël Barrot repeated the accusation, calling her remarks outrageous and reprehensible and demanding her removal from the UN. Germany, Austria, Italy, and the Czech Republic all lined up to condemn her. There was just one problem. She never said it. A transcript of her actual remarks, reviewed by Reuters, showed no such statement. Reports later emerged that an AI-manipulated video was the source of the allegations, but the damage was done. The Czech foreign minister quoted the false statement on X and called for her resignation. The Austrian foreign minister posted the same accusation, then quietly deleted it after being called out for spreading disinformation. But where was the apology? Where was the retraction? Silence. Francesca Albanese responded with the kind of moral clarity that terrifies her accusers. She posted on X, "Three European governments accuse me, based on statements I never made, with a virulence and conviction that they have never used against those who have slaughtered 20,000 plus children in 858 days. She was referencing the Palestinian Health Ministry's figures, which now show more than 72,000 people killed in Gaza. The UN itself was forced to defend her. A UN human rights spokesperson expressed concern about what they called personal attacks, threats, and misinformation targeting independent experts. The UN Coordination Committee, a body of six independent experts, issued a rare statement accusing European ministers of relying on manufactured facts. They pointed out the obvious hypocrisy. Instead of attacking Albanese for doing her job, these governments should be working to hold accountable those accused of war crimes and crimes against humanity in Gaza and the West Bank. Think about that. A UN human rights expert was sanctioned by the United States for writing letters. That is the level of desperation we are dealing with. Yet, despite all of this, Albanese has not backed down, and she is not alone. Over 100 European lawmakers signed a statement supporting her, condemning the French government's call for her resignation as based on distorted remarks and manipulated content. more than 100 prominent artists, including Mark Ruffalo, Javier Bardem, Annie Lennox, and Annie Ernaux, signed an open letter offering their full support to Francesca Albanese, a defender of human rights and therefore also of the Palestinian people's right to exist. The smear campaign failed. Albanese remains in her position. There is no precedent for removing a UN special rapporteur during their term, and diplomats acknowledge that strong support for Palestinian rights within the Human Rights Council makes such a motion unlikely to pass. But the attempt itself reveals the truth. They are terrified of her. They are terrified of anyone who speaks with authority about what is really happening. And then there is Tucker Carlson. If Francesca Albanese represents the institutional voice of human rights, Tucker Carlson represents the populist voice of millions of Americans who are waking up. Since being ousted from Fox News in 2023, Carlson has built the most powerful independent media platform in the country. His YouTube channel has over 5 million subscribers. His episodes regularly go viral. And over the past year, he has done something that no mainstream journalist has dared to do. He has gone to the Holy Land and shown the world the truth about what is happening to Christians under Israeli occupation. Earlier this month, in February 2026, Carlson published an episode titled, "How Does the U.S.-Funded Israeli Government Treat Christians in the Holy Land?" He hosted the Archbishop of Jerusalem, Hossam Naum, who testified about repeated settler attacks on Christian villages and communities. The Archbishop described the declining end of Christian presence in the Holy Land and recounted being spat on in Jerusalem by Jewish extremists. Carlson highlighted that many of the refugees who were expelled by force from their land were Christians, and that the Christian population has dwindled to half since 1948. So now I quietly ask, what is the end game? Why the pressure? Why the censorship? Why the erasure of Palestinian identity, culture, and history? Some analysts argue that the goal is not just to control the narrative about Gaza or the West Bank, it's to shape the entire regional story, to normalize the idea that one state's interests supersede the rights of millions, to make the world believe that Palestinians are aggressors, not victims, that they are invaders, not indigenous, that they are obstacles, not people. And when you control the narrative, you control the public imagination. And when you control the public imagination, you control policy. And when you control policy, you control the future. This is why the erasure of the word Palestine matters. This is why the renaming of food matters. This is why the silencing of influencers matters. This is why the firing of anchors matters. This is why the banning of flags matters. Because each act, small or large, is part of a larger project to reshape the story of an entire people. That here's the part they didn't expect. The world pushed back. People from every background, every faith, every country began speaking up. They refused to be intimidated. They refused to be silenced. They refused to accept a narrative that contradicted what they saw with their own eyes. And that is why this moment matters. Not because of politicians, not because of governments, not because of institutions, but because of people, ordinary people. People who decided that truth was worth defending. And that is where the story continues. If it takes a visit to the occupied land to finally understand what is happening there, then perhaps everyone should visit. Because once you stand on that soil, once you see the checkpoints, the walls, the restrictions, the fear, and the resilience with your own eyes, the narrative changes. It becomes impossible to rely on headlines or political statements. The truth becomes something you witness, not something you're told. We have reached a point where we can no longer depend on mainstream news media to deliver an honest account of what Palestinians are living through. The coverage is filtered, softened, reframed, or stripped of context. And the moment a reporter or anchor dares to ask a difficult question, one that challenges the official line, they are flagged, reprimanded, or quietly removed from the air. We've seen it again and again. Journalists disciplined for doing their job, for asking the questions that journalism was created to ask. And when the pressure on traditional media wasn't enough, the next frontier became social media. Platforms that once promised openness and free expression slowly shifted toward heavy moderation, selective enforcement, and algorithmic suppression. Posts disappeared, accounts were shadow banned, entire pages vanished overnight. Voices that spoke for Palestine, Muslim, Christian, Jewish, secular, found themselves silenced, not because they violated rules, but because they violated expectations. So what are we left with? What tools remain? Right now, the only thing we can truly rely on is witnessing. Seeing with our own eyes, listening to the people who live there, hearing the stories that never make it to the evening news. Because when you stand in Bethlehem or Ramallah or Hebron or Gaza, when you see the checkpoints, the demolished homes, the separation wall cutting through ancient neighborhoods, you understand that no headline can capture this reality. No press release can sanitize it. No political statement can explain it away. And that is why visits matter. That is why presence matters. That is why bearing witness matters. When someone travels to the occupied land, they return changed. They return with clarity. They return with a truth that cannot be unlearned. And that truth becomes a kind of responsibility, a responsibility to speak, to share, to challenge the narratives that have been used for decades to obscure Palestinian suffering. We are living in a moment where ordinary people have become the last line of accountability, not governments, not institutions, not major networks. People. People with phones, cameras, and the courage to tell the world what they see. And that is why the movement continues to grow. Not because the media told the truth, but because the people did. Not because the powerful opened their eyes, but because the powerless refused to close theirs. In the end, witnessing is not just an act of observation, it is an act of resistance. It is a refusal to let anyone else define reality for us. It is a commitment to truth in a time when truth is constantly under pressure. And as long as people continue to see, to listen, and to speak, the story of Palestine will not be erased. Not by censorship, not by silence, not by fear. And that brings us to talk about former Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene and Bethlehem Mayor Maher Kanawati. Former Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene made headlines in mid-February 2026 when she traveled to the West Bank city of Bethlehem and met with its mayor, Maher Kanawati, a prominent Palestinian Christian leader. Her visit drew international attention because it intersected with several sensitive issues: the shrinking Christian population in the Holy Land, the political tensions surrounding the Israeli occupation, and Greene's own reputation as a polarizing figure in U.S. politics. According to multiple reports, Greene announced the visit publicly on February 15, 2026, posting photos and statements on her social media accounts. She described the meeting as an honor, emphasizing Bethlehem's significance as the birthplace of Jesus and framing her trip as a fact-finding mission focused on the condition of Christian communities in the region. During the meeting, Mayor Maher Qanawati briefed Green on what he described as the growing pressures facing Palestinian Christians. He told her that Christians had been killed in Israeli bombardments in Gaza and that churches across the Palestinian territories had come under attack. He also highlighted the ongoing issue of settler expansion, explaining that Christian families in Bethlehem only want to live in peace alongside their Jewish and Muslim neighbors, yet continue to face the loss of homes and property due to settlement activity. Green echoed these concerns in her public statements, claiming that Bethlehem, once a 41-square-mile city, had effectively been reduced to about 7 square miles due to Israeli land seizures and the construction of military checkpoints. She cited a figure of 139 Israeli checkpoints surrounding or connected to Bethlehem, which she argued severely restricts movement, economic life, and access to religious sites. In her remarks, Green repeatedly used the phrase Christian persecution, asserting that American Christians are largely unaware of the hardships faced by their Palestinian counterparts. She urged U.S. audiences to pay closer attention to the situation, asking rhetorically, "What is the Holy Land without Christians?" Mayor Qanawati, who has long advocated for international support to preserve Bethlehem's Christian presence, emphasized that the city's Christian population has been declining for decades due to economic hardship, political instability, and emigration. He described local Christians as the living stones of the Holy Land, communities whose presence is essential to maintaining the region's religious identity. Green's visit also carried symbolic and diplomatic weight. U.S. lawmakers who visit the West Bank typically balance meetings with both Israeli and Palestinian officials. Green's decision to highlight Christian concerns in Bethlehem was seen by some analysts as an appeal to her evangelical base in the United States, where interest in the Holy Land is often tied to religious identity and biblical history. During the meeting, Mayor Qanawati presented Green with a commemorative medal, along with a stone from the Church of the Nativity and a piece of wood from its historic roof, gestures meant to honor her visit and underscore Bethlehem's deep Christian heritage. The visit sparked debate across political and religious communities. Supporters praised Green for drawing attention to the challenges facing Palestinian Christians, a topic often overshadowed in Western media coverage. Critics, however, questioned her framing of the issue and noted that Palestinian Christian leaders typically attribute their hardships to a combination of occupation-related restrictions, economic decline, and regional instability, not solely to religious persecution. Still, Green's trip succeeded in bringing renewed attention to the fragile status of Christian communities in Bethlehem, where demographic shifts have been dramatic. Historical records show that Jerusalem alone saw its Christian population drop by roughly 70% in the months following the 1948 displacement, and today only about 9,900 Christians remain in the city. Bethlehem has experienced similar long-term decline. In the end, Green's visit underscored a reality that Palestinian Christian leaders have been voicing for years, that their communities are shrinking, their mobility is restricted, and their future in the land where Christianity was born is increasingly uncertain. Now imagine living in a city that has been reduced to just 7 square miles, surrounded by 139 Israeli checkpoints. Imagine every movement monitored, every road restricted, every ordinary task shaped by occupation. This is the daily reality for Palestinians in Bethlehem and across the West Bank. And yet, time after time, we hear Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu repeat the same line, that Israel is the only place in the Middle East where Christians can practice their religion freely. But the lived experience of Palestinian Christians tells a very different story. Under occupation, neither Muslims nor Christians enjoy true freedom of movement, freedom of worship, or freedom to live without fear. These are not abstract claims. They are documented realities shared by families, clergy, and community leaders across Bethlehem, Jerusalem, and Gaza. This is why former Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene's visit to Bethlehem mattered. Her trip was overdue, but it was significant. She sat with Mayor Maher An-Kanawati, listened to the concerns of Palestinian Christians, and saw firsthand the pressures they face. And while her willingness to make the journey is appreciated, the full picture requires acknowledging the experiences of all Palestinians, Muslim and Christian alike. Their struggle is shared. Their suffering is intertwined. Their lives are shaped by the same system of control. Greene's visit highlighted one truth. You cannot understand the reality of Palestinian Christians without understanding the reality of Palestinian Muslims. They live under the same checkpoints, the same land restrictions, the same economic suffocation, the same political pressure. Their futures are bound together, and any honest conversation about freedom in the Holy Land must include both. Another thing you need to hear, and it's about the British Museum removes Palestine from ancient Middle East displays. The British Museum has removed the word Palestine from several of its ancient Middle East exhibits after receiving complaints from a pro-Israel legal group, UK Lawyers for Israel. The group argued that the museum was using the term retroactively to describe regions and peoples that existed long before the name Palestine appeared in historical records. The museum's displays had previously labeled parts of the eastern Mediterranean coast as Palestine and described some ancient peoples, such as the Hyksos, as being of Palestinian descent. After the complaint, curators replaced these references with terms like Canaan and Canaanite descent, saying that Palestine was not a meaningful geographic term for the periods in question. UK Lawyers for Israel claimed that using Palestine across thousands of years creates a false impression of continuity and erases the kingdoms of Israel and Judea, arguing that it reframes Jewish origins as stemming from Palestine. The museum stated that the decision followed audience research and feedback, and that it aims to avoid anachronistic terminology in ancient displays. It also said it uses UN-recognized terminology for modern maps, such as Gaza, West Bank, Israel, and Jordan, and still uses Palestinian as a cultural or ethnographic identifier where appropriate. However, the move has been sharply criticized by scholars and activists who argue that removing the term Palestine is part of a broader pattern of erasing Palestinian history and identity. Academics interviewed by Middle East Eye noted that ancient Palestine is a historically valid term used in classical studies, and that claims of its illegitimacy serve political aims rather than historical accuracy. Critics also point out that the region has been known by many names, Canaan, Israel, Judea, Phoenicia, Palestine, depending on the era and the ruling power. The earliest textual reference to Israel appears in an Egyptian inscription around 1200 BC, while the Greek historian Herodotus used the term Palestine in the 5th century BC. The controversy reflects a larger debate about how museums represent contested histories and how political pressure can shape public understanding of ancient cultures. Some advocacy groups say the museum's decision reinforces modern political narratives at the expense of historical complexity. Now, the last thing for today. Israel is advancing a highly controversial bill that would introduce the death penalty for Palestinians accused of killing Israelis in what the state defines as acts of terrorism. The proposal, pushed by far-right members of the government, has already passed its first reading in the Knesset. If enacted, it would allow military courts in the occupied West Bank to impose death sentences by a simple majority, and civilian courts inside Israel to mandate execution in cases deemed motivated by racism or hostility toward the state. Clearly, the bill is designed to apply almost exclusively to Palestinians, creating an openly discriminatory legal system. Human rights organizations warn that it violates international law, removes judicial discretion, and risks state-sanctioned wrongful executions. Supporters claim it will deter attacks, while opponents, including legal experts and some Israeli families of victims, say it will only inflame violence and deepen apartheid conditions. Though not yet law, Israeli prison authorities have already begun preparing facilities and procedures for executions, signaling how seriously the government is pursuing this unprecedented shift. Earlier this month, more than 1,000 people signed an online petition opposing Israel's proposed death penalty bill. The outcry grew quickly, reflecting deep concern over the bill's discriminatory intent and its implications for human rights. This petition, circulated widely through Counterpunch, calls attention to the dangers of state-sanctioned executions and the targeting of Palestinians. It urges the international community to recognize the gravity of this moment and to speak out before irreversible harm is done. It also demands accountability from Israeli lawmakers who continue to push policies that violate international law. The petition is a collective plea for justice, dignity, and the protection of life. I'm going to read you the newsletter exactly as it appeared in the Counterpunch newsletter. We, the thousands of international members of L'Chaim, Jews Against the Death Penalty, applaud and affirm our Israeli members and friends for the new online petition that Zazim recently disseminated against National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir's proposed death penalty. In the days since this petition went live, it has already amassed over 5,000 signatures. Given that the petition is appropriately in Hebrew, L'Chaim felt it would be appropriate to translate it here for our non-Israeli members worldwide. The organization Zazim, meaning We Are Moving or Let's Move, constitutes the largest campaigning community in Israel with more than 350,000 activities and activists. It is a civil movement of Arabs and Jews who together promote democracy, equality, and active and participatory citizenship. Zazim is political. Its campaigns deal with the most pressing issues on the public agenda and are designed to influence decision makers. It is, however, nonpartisan. Zazim is an independent movement, and what unites its members are shared values of human rights and social and environmental justice. Zazim's petition is entitled No to the Law of Death. Its contents, as translated below, are unambiguous in opposing the death penalty bill. We citizens oppose Ben-Gvir's racist death penalty bill and demand that the opposition raise its voice and oppose it on every platform and with all the tools at its disposal. Why is this important? If we do not act now, we are partners and accomplices in the establishment of Ben-Gvir's hanging state. The death penalty bill he is promoting will apply in the West Bank to a Palestinian who murders an Israeli as a mandatory sentence and without the possibility of mitigation. The bill was carefully drafted to create racism under the protection of the law. The death penalty will not apply, for example, to settlers who murder a Palestinian resident of the West Bank. If we are pro-life, we must speak out against the death penalty bill and demand that Yair Lapid and his opposition colleagues do the same. Right now, Lapid and the others are avoiding a clear position as the bill moves rapidly toward final approval in the Knesset. This is the last moment to make an impact. The truth is, the bill has a majority in the Knesset because the opposition Yisrael Beiteinu supports it, along with the government. If that's not enough, Lapid and the heads of the opposition factions have not declared sweeping opposition to the bill. But we have an opportunity. The Haredim are swinging, and we can and will influence Yesh Atid and some members of the state camp. If we create enough noise, the government may decide it is better to postpone the vote on approving the law and avoid conflict. Lachaya members, by the very name of our organization, salute the petition focus on the inviolability of life. In this sense, it reflects the Jewish communal statement opposing the death penalty bill in Israel that went public last week, which itself illustrates the immense scope of reputable Israeli and Jewish groups that are standing firmly against this legislation. That statement's uplifting of the sanctity of life, in turn, builds upon the documented massive scale of rabbinic voices who already stand against the death penalty for this reason. As members of a global Jewish community committed to Israel's future, the statement concludes, we urge Israeli leaders to halt this legislation and to reaffirm values that have long guided Jewish life, the sanctity of human life and the dignity of every person. Indeed, if enacted, the death penalty bill currently before the Israeli Knesset would constitute a violation of arguably the most fundamental of all human rights, the right to life itself. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights, UDHR, a foundational document of the United Nations adopted in 1948, clearly established this human right. It is therefore logical that the United Nations Human Rights Chief, Volker Türk, denounced Israel for its proposed legislation to execute Palestinians. Türk reminded Israel that, when it comes to the death penalty, the United Nations is obvious and opposes it under all circumstances. Any nation that engages in the blatant human rights violation that is capital punishment inherently fails the litmus test for a civilized society. The latest iteration of Israel's proposed death penalty bill for convicted terrorists is no exception. On the contrary, it only provides further evidence of how quickly any procedural safeguards and notions of humanitarian practices evaporate once a civilization opens itself to the veritable dons macabre of state-sponsored killing. Attorney Robert Dunham, director of the Death Penalty Policy Project and former executive director of the Death Penalty Information Center, encapsulated it best when he wrote that the current bill is a walking human rights violation. There are numerous motivators for individuals and organizations advocating for death penalty abolition. Beyond the arguments centering on religion, racism, false deterrence, incitement of martyrs, and inviolability of life that the Jewish communal statement cited above reflects, L'Chaim, Jews Against the Death Penalty, has repeatedly outlined many other reasons for standing against capital punishment now and always. These include the fact that executions always constitute torture, risk executing the innocent, and from Adolf Hitler to Donald Trump to Ben Gvir, have been used as a political tool, particularly during election campaigns. L'Chaim has also illustrated how many execution methods are direct Nazi legacies, including firing squad, gassing, and lethal injection. Famed death penalty abolitionist Elie Wiesel best articulated L'Chaim's stance when he said of capital punishment in the shadow of the Holocaust that death should never be the answer in a civilized society. Members of the Knesset and all death penalty proponents should heed Wiesel's message and the thousands of signatories of this online petition. They should recognize that executions are never the answer and that Israel's proposed death penalty bill should not be the answer now. There are numerous motivators for individuals and organizations advocating for death penalty abolition. Beyond the arguments centering on religion, racism, false deterrence, incitement of martyrs, and inviolability of life that the Jewish communal statement cited above reflects, L'Chaim, Jews Against the Death Penalty, has repeatedly outlined many other reasons for standing against capital punishment now and always. These include the fact that executions always constitute torture, risk executing the innocent, and, from Adolf Hitler to Donald Trump to Ben Gvir, have been used as a political tool, particularly during election campaigns. L'Chaim has also illustrated how many execution methods are direct Nazi legacies, including firing squad, gassing, and lethal injection. Famed death penalty abolitionist Elie Wiesel best articulated L'Chaim's stance when he said of capital punishment in the shadow of the Holocaust that death should never be the answer in a civilized society. Members of the Knesset and all death penalty proponents should heed Wiesel's message and the thousands of signatories of this online petition. They should recognize that executions are never the answer and that Israel's proposed death penalty bill should not be the answer now. And with that, we close this week's episode. As always, stay curious, stay courageous, and keep asking the questions that unsettle power, cut through silence, and move us closer to justice. I'm Abby Masri, your host and narrator. It has been a profound honor to share this space with you, a space where truth is spoken without hesitation, where resistance is held with reverence, and where solidarity is never conditional and never up for negotiation. If you have reflections or questions, or if you feel called to step behind the mic as a future host, we welcome your voice. Reach us anytime at twippodcasts@gmail.com. To our listeners, thank you. Thank you for your time, your trust, and your willingness to walk this difficult road with us. And to the remarkable team whose dedication keeps this platform alive, Bob Funk, Stanley Robinson, Stephen Lowe, Sophia Rose Woolman, Tahani Abu Mosa, Dr. Bethany Marks, Dr. Rana Awad, Professor Yara Rashid, Juliet Salome Olivier, Reynard Al-Ghul, and our editor, Muhammad Al-Ghul. Your labor, your spirit, and your unwavering commitment are the heartbeat of this show. Each week, you remind us that storytelling is more than a craft. It is an inheritance of struggle and devotion. It is resistance. It is care. It is collective memory. Until next time, keep walking toward truth, keep walking toward Palestine. This Week in Palestine is a production of Truth and Justice Radio, proudly broadcasting for more than 20 years from WZBC Student Radio at Boston College. If you miss this radio hour, you can find us on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Podcast Index, iHeartRadio, Podcast Addict, Podchaser, Pocket Casts, Deezer, Listen Notes, Overcast, Casto, Castbox, Player FM, Good Pods, and True Fans. You can also explore all our archived episodes throughout the previous years on radioforall.net and archive.org. Simply search for This Week in Palestine, or TWIP, and look for the image of the little girl raising her hands in the victory gesture. You can also find us on Million Podcasts. Million Podcasts is a platform built to help creators grow their shows and to make it easier for listeners to discover new voices. Visit their website at www.millionpodcasts.com and explore a wide range of Arab American podcasts, including ours. Thank you for being here. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week. Until then, take care. Stay steadfast. It's not Israel. It's the occupied land. It's Palestine. Free Palestine. From the river to the sea.